Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, May 17th. I'm your reader, Natalie Chin. The first article is Iowa Rebuilds PPE Stockpile After Deals with Unusual Sources by Ryan J. Foley from the Associated Press. Iowa has rebuilt its stockpile of personal protective equipment after a dire shortage that prompted the state to buy through unusual sources, including $7 million in contracts for gowns and goggles, with a business known for making Republican campaign signs. Iowa's executive branch signed $45 million worth of emergency purchase orders for isolation gowns, masks, face shields, goggles, and other equipment from mid-March through April, documents obtained by the Associated Press show. The deals include 590,000 masks that were purchased directly from China and several with businesses that have never before supplied such materials. In three contracts worth $7.2 million, the state agreed to purchase 1 million isolation gowns and 100,000 clear plastic goggles through Competitive Edge Incorporated, a Des Moines business that has never sold either. The company supplies promotional items, like t-shirts, and has long been a go-to vendor for Republican campaigns buying yard and barn signs. Owner David Greenspan, a former Republican appointee on the Iowa Finance Authority Board, said state agencies reached out unsolicited asking for help securing supplies from China because he has long imported from there. Now Greenspan said he's overseeing manufacturing in three Chinese factories, and the items will be delivered to Iowa over the next month. Quote, "We were lucky enough to get some business. I am happy about that. I like to be busy," he said. "It's been a tough few months, but we didn't close through any of it. Maybe that was fortuitous. When somebody from the state called, we were here," unquote. Greenspan is charging the state $6.96 per gown and $2.59 for each pair of goggles. He said neither item will be medical grade. The contracts didn't have to go through the mandatory open bidding process. Governor Kim Reynolds suspended those requirements for all goods and services needed to fight the coronavirus in a March 9th emergency proclamation. The governor said Friday the state has started to receive orders that were placed in March, allowing its inventory to be rebuilt. "Our stockpile is in a good place right now," Reynolds said. Executive branch spokeswoman Tammy Venchek said Iowa has ordered 33.6 million items since February and received more than half of them. She said orders for 1 million other items were canceled after the vendor could not fulfill them on the state's timeline. A spreadsheet obtained by the Associated Press shows Iowa's inventory includes 8.8 million surgical masks, 664,000 face shields, 356,000 respirators, 1.3 million gloves, and 67,000 isolation gowns. But a shortage of goggles still exists. These figures do not include millions of additional items the Iowa National Guard has delivered to all 99 counties. The situation has improved since the pandemic arrived in Iowa 2 months ago amid a national shortage of supplies, alarming healthcare officials. On March 22nd, a top Iowa Department of Public Health official emailed University of Iowa experts asking whether used protective equipment could be disinfected by UV light or chemicals and reworn. Ken Sharp, Iowa's Director of Acute Disease Prevention, Emergency Response, and Environmental Health, also asked them to brainstorm what off-the-wall solutions may be viable if traditional equipment was unavailable. Quote, "I realize these sound like desperate questions, but we are planning in unusual times and need to give consideration to all potential options," Sharp wrote in the email obtained by the Associated Press. On April 10th, his department declared a shortage of personal protective equipment and directed healthcare providers to use face masks for treating multiple patients, use washable gowns, and shorten hospital stays to preserve respirators. Supplies that were beyond their expiration dates could also be used. That order remains in effect. Some healthcare workers report having trouble finding adequate supplies despite the replenished state stockpile. It's unclear whether taxpayers are getting good value for their money. Contracts show the state has paid vastly different prices for similar products. In March, the state purchased 400 8-ounce bottles of hand sanitizer from an out-of-state vendor for $4.69 apiece. Then in April, the state signed a contract with an Iowa company to produce hand sanitizer for a fraction of that cost, $10 apiece per 128-ounce bottles. The state has paid between $4.64 and $19.35 for each isolation gown. Goggles have ranged from $1.12 apiece to $2.85, and disposable face shields have varied from $1.25 apiece to $3. The state purchased 590,000 face shields directly from a Chinese exporter for $938,000, or $1.59 per shield. That equipment was to be flown from China to an Ankeny food warehouse on March 27th, purchasing order shows. The state is buying 100,000 disposable face shields for $3 apiece from Honeycore Acquisition LLC, a Fairfield packing and distribution company that had never made them before. CEO Nate Wheaton said the $3 price was fair, saying similar items have been marketed for $5 or $7. Quote, "We wanted a cost-competitive and cost-conscientious product and to make sure we weren't gouging," he said. "We think that's where we ended up," unquote. Next up, Iowa reports 5 more coronavirus deaths. It's the lowest daily death toll in days. The state Sunday reported 5 more deaths due to the novel coronavirus. The first time in 6 days, Iowa has not seen a double-digit daily death tally. The Iowa Department of Public Health also reported 323 new positive cases of the disease, up from Saturday's report. A total of 14,651 Iowans have tested positive for COVID-19 since the disease was confirmed March 8th in Iowa. The state death total is 351. Saturday saw 279 positive cases, the lowest amount in a week, and 10 deaths. There were 374 positive cases reported Friday and 18 deaths. Current hospitalizations decreased Sunday from 387 to 376. There was one new long-term care facility outbreak in the state reported, bringing that total to 37. If you have any comments, you can call 319-398-8259 or contact jeff.johnson at thegazette.com. And coronavirus masks a boon for crooks who hide their faces. There's a troubling new reality for law enforcement in the age of the coronavirus. The way the FBI tells it, William Rosario Lopez put on a surgical mask and walked into the Connecticut convenience store looking to the world like a typical pandemic-era shopper as he picked up plastic wrap, fruit snacks, and a few other items. Then, when the only other customer left, he went to the counter, pulled out a small pistol, pointed it at the clerk, and demanded that he open the cash register. The scene, the FBI contends in a court document, was repeated by Lopez in 4 other gas station stores over 8 days before his April 9th arrest. It underscores a troubling new reality for law enforcement. Masks that have made criminals stand apart long before bandana-wearing robbers knocked over stagecoaches in the Old West, and ski-masked bandits held up banks now allow them to blend in like concerned accountants, nurses, and store clerks trying to avoid a deadly virus. Quote, "Criminals, they're smart, and this is a perfect opportunity for them to conceal themselves and blend right in," said Richard Bell, police chief in the tiny Pennsylvania community of Frackville. He said he knows of 7 recent armed robberies in the region where every suspect wore a mask. Across the United States, masks have become more and more prevalent, first as a voluntary precaution, and then as a requirement imposed by governmental agencies and businesses. And people with masks, as well as latex gloves, have found their way into more and more crime reports. Just how many criminals are taking advantage of the pandemic to commit crimes is impossible to estimate, but law enforcement officials have no doubt the numbers are climbing. Reports are starting to pop up across the United States and in other parts of the world of crimes pulled off in no small part because so many of us are now wearing masks. In March, 2 men walked into Aqueduct Racetrack in New York wearing the same kind of surgical masks as many racing fans there and, at gunpoint, robbed 3 workers of $250,000 they were moving from gaming machines to a safe. Other robberies involving suspects wearing surgical masks have occurred in North Carolina and Washington, D.C., and elsewhere in recent weeks. The problem isn't limited to robberies. In the troubled Cook County Jail in Chicago, the virus has led to at least 9 deaths and sickened hundreds of inmates and correctional officers. Staffers must wear masks, and inmates are issued a new one every day, a policy that helped one inmate escape on May 2nd. Jacques Scott, jailed on a gun charge and for violating his bond in a drug case, has tattoos of a small heart on one cheek and what looks like a blood-dripping scar on the other. But when he wore a mask, he posed as Quentin Henderson, who doesn't have tattoos on his face and was scheduled to be released, authorities said. Scott made it out, though he was captured a week later. In addition to rare jailbreaks, the prevalence of masks in society has created other problems for law enforcement. Before life in a pandemic, masked marauders had to free their faces immediately after leaving a bank or store to avoid suspicion once in the general public. But it came with the risk of being photographed and identified through omnipresent surveillance cameras and cell phones. These days, they can keep the masks on and blend in easily with or without being captured in images. Quote, "The video is much less useful if we are unable to see a face," said Carlos Marquez, a detective division commander in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, in an email. It's leaving law enforcement without a crucial crime-solving tool. Quote, guys are like, okay, I have to wear a mask. The police are not going to stop me on the way to a crime and back from a crime wearing a mask, said Brendan Dinahan, chief of detectives for Chicago Police Department. Now, if you're going to commit a crime, you can leave your house with a mask on and drive for an hour, unquote. With everyone basically incognito, would-be witnesses might not notice someone acting differently, and that would make it harder to get a good description or identification of the suspect, said Eric Nunez, chief of the Los Alamitos Police Department in Southern California and president of the California Police Chiefs Association. It's less likely now that other shoppers would stare at them, just making mental notes of what they look like, Nunez said. If they look like everybody else walking in, they may not do that at all. It's a real problem for clerks and tellers, such as Tiffany Becker, who manages a Valero convenience store in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, where a number of stores in the area have been robbed by mask-wearing gunmen recently. Quote, "Before I would have called the police because having a mask wasn't normal. Now it's normal," Becker said. "It's scary because you can't tell who is safe and who's not," unquote. Even when investigators identify suspects, the protective gear makes putting cases together all that much more difficult. The same latex gloves more people are wearing to protect themselves from picking up the virus will mean fewer fingerprints at crime scenes. Quote, "In the past, if you did a search warrant and you found surgical masks, that would be highly indicative of something suspicious," said FBI Special Agent Lisa McNamara, who investigated the string of robberies in Connecticut that led to the arrest of Rosario Lopez. Now, everybody has masks or latex gloves, unquote. But the reverse can also be true. McNamara and her team's investigation was made easier when his alleged accomplice went into the stores acting as a lookout or casing robbery locations. The accomplice hadn't worn a mask. And then we are moving on to the opinion section. What does it mean to go to church in a pandemic? For almost all of 2016 and 2017, I drove around the Midwest and went to church. I was writing a book about faith in the Midwest and how it was changing, and how it was changing our culture. I went to megachurches in Minneapolis and small Presbyterian churches in Indiana. I had coffee with atheists and went to a picnic with pagans and worshipped in three languages at the Asian American Reformed Church in Bigelow, Minnesota. What I discovered was that churches are our repositories for community. They are the keepers of our births and deaths and weddings. Even if you don't believe, church and faith are still woven into how we conceive of what it means to be American. According to Gallup, church attendance hovered around 39% in the 1930s and 1940s. It increased in the 1950s, when Dwight D. Eisenhower encouraged Americans everywhere to go to services. This was the sales pitch. America was now at war with communism, which he believed was perpetuated by atheism. Americans could differentiate themselves from the godless hordes by exercising their freedom of religion. The call was taken up by religious leaders such as Billy Graham, and soon going to church was more than just something for the religious. It was part of being a good American. In a global pandemic, churches have once again become a Gordian knot of faith and political identity. Headlines are filled with pastors and congregants defying stay-at-home orders to go to church because Jesus, they believe, will save them. In Iowa, Governor Reynolds was quick to lift the restrictions on large gatherings for churches, noting the constitutional right to freedom of religion. When the vice president came to Iowa, he didn't meet with scientists or researchers. He met with business leaders and church leaders. And yet, church is also the place researchers believe to be the most dangerous for virus spread. Churches are indoors, where people are in close contact, where social distancing is hard, and where singing increases the spread of saliva droplets. Churches are also centers of compassion and grace and hope. While I have been to several churches in town where I've heard homophobia and racism preached from the pulpit, I've also been to churches where I've received welcome and kindness I've never experienced elsewhere. When the pandemic hit and churches switched to Zoom and Facebook Live, I felt acutely what was being missed. The crying baby while we say the Lord's Prayer, the toddler who keeps racing up to the pulpit with her crooked ponytails and smug smile, the way the light moves across the altar as the service goes on, and the peace we give to one another through handshakes and hugs. Some things just don't work as well over the internet. Sometimes the true hope is in the gathering together of disparate people, young and old, to sit them together in a place, make them share bread and wine, and think about how to be better. I've had a hard time attending a video church. I've listened, but the sound is bad, and the music tinny, and my kids run away. I want to go back. But I also, as a person of faith, want to take care of those around me. And it's encouraging as I watch video after video on church Facebook pages. The majority of pastors I hear across denominations are urging caution and care for our community. They are opening slowly. They are only opening when they can be sure that it will be safe for everyone. The churches in the headlines are not the churches of the majority. It's complicated. Churches have spurred the liberation movements of civil rights, but they've also pushed hard against LGBTQ rights. And here we are again, churches both a space of hope in a pandemic and a locus of disease. And I don't know how to reconcile the voice of America and the heart of America. The inspiration and the infection seem so tied up in the same spaces. This weekend marks the first weekend that all 99 counties in Iowa will begin to reopen. Our governor is leaving it up to us to decide how much COVID we get. So many Iowans don't get a choice. They have to go back to work and risk the virus or lose their livelihood. My hairstylist tells me she has to see clients. If not enough want to come back, she won't be able to eat. But she can no longer get unemployment. She doesn't have a choice. In a recent Gazette story, co-owner of LP Street Food, Justin Zare, summed it up when he said of the opening, quote, "It's very limiting. If you were to create a business model of 50% off of your seats, you wouldn't be staying open. It's a regulation that's designed to make us fail." But Zare and so many other restaurant owners don't have a choice. The governor has shifted the burden to us. Like Pontius Pilate, she's washing her hands and leaving it up to the masses. Jesus or Barabbas, someone will still die. And yet here we are, longing for the spaces that define us, but could prove to be the most fatal, not knowing what to do. So many Americans are now on ventilators and coughing, sick and dying for air. Even the healthy can spread the disease with our breath and our voices, the very things we use to worship. I keep thinking about something my pastor said once on a Sunday when I dragged myself to church, tired and, yes, hungover. She said that sometimes it feels like all you can do is breathe, but in breath there is air, and in air there is nature, and in nature there is God. So every breath is an act of the divine. I don't know where that leaves us, but each breath is a divine transaction with those around us. Each breath now is an act of faith. And that was written by Liz Lentz from the Gazette. You can reach her at lyz.lentz, L-E-N-Z, at thegazette.com. Also at the phone number 319-450-0547. Another opinion piece, there ought to be a song called Stay at Home Blues by Kurt Ulrich. A few days ago, I drove into a nearby town to get some gasoline. In front of me at a traffic light was a huge pickup truck proudly displaying the Trumpian declaration, Make Donald Drumpf Again. It was a dubious message on a couple of levels, most obviously the fact that the truck was a Japanese Toyota. I suppose I could have pointed these things out to the driver, but in this rural county where I live, fully 1 in 4 adults have a legal permit to carry, which means they holster guns. It's bad enough that I'm at risk for the coronavirus, but getting shot is not on my list of things to do. A small flock of Canadian geese flew over the house this afternoon, winging their way south, honking and chatting the whole time. I enjoy order and want things to be as they have always been. Thus, I wanted to yell at them, "Turn around! You're headed in the wrong direction!" Speaking of order, I've taken to using the guest bed. Only one guest for one night in more than 20 years out here, as a staging area for any newly laundered and folded clothes. Before the coronavirus, I faithfully put each piece in the proper drawer or hung it neatly in a closet. If there isn't a song called Stay at Home Blues, there ought to be. Dishes often sit on my counter for a couple of days before being washed. No dishwasher here. I just don't care any longer. Perhaps you know the feeling. Our state of Iowa is opening up the economy thanks to a governor who has long provided cover for he who must not be named, and the number of dead and dying continues to rise at an alarming rate. It all troubles me greatly. Puts me in a mind of a wonderful song from the mid-1960s by Country Joe and the Fish, titled I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die Rag, wherein Joe sings, "Well, there ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die." I've seen folks die for lack of air in their lungs. There is nothing gentle or peaceful about it. It's a horrible death. Long after the brain has given up, the body continues to grasp for air, and I do wonder if some of our leaders would act differently if they too had seen loved ones die this way. Perhaps I'm naive. Outdoor activities make me feel better, so I spend an inordinate amount of time out on my drive doing odd things like sharpening and resharpening my axes and hatchets, all while listening to my longtime resident squirrel yelling at me. She's really quite cute, and over the years has added onto her nest 40 feet up in an old cedar tree out back, so now her nest is quite large, I think is what he meant to say. I'd like to think she has a flat-screen television and a leather sofa up there. Down in the hollow, wild plum trees have blossomed, very pretty, very fragrant, and, when ripe, the plums are extraordinarily tart, suck in your cheeks so that for a moment you look thinner, kind of tart. I know this, but every summer, I bite into one anyway. Perhaps science can find a way to use wild plums to cure the coronavirus. Makes about as much sense as what we're getting from our leaders. And let me add that I am uniquely qualified to put forth wild plums as a cure for the coronavirus, as I passed a required college biology class on the second try because my lab mate was pretty smart and nice to me, so I actually showed up to class. I don't recall her name, but I hope she is healthy, and I hope you are as well. Kurt Ulrich lives in rural Jackson County. His book, The Iowa State Fair, is available from the University of Iowa Press. Sorry about the jumping around today. Going back to coronavirus news, as Iowa reopens, state's virus data elusive. Citing lack of help from Reynolds, some keep their own tallies. By Vanessa Miller. By Vanessa Miller from the Gazette, they don't have any punctuation splitting that up. For the past 9 weeks, 68-year-old Debbie Buck has been isolating with her husband, Dennis Fett, at their rural home and Peacock Farm in western Iowa's Pottawatomie County, which has seen its known cases of coronavirus spike over 300% in 2 weeks. For most, if not all, of that time, she has been tuning in to watch Governor Kim Reynolds' nearly daily updates, eagerly awaiting what she perceived as among the most important information, the number of new cases and deaths. At first, Reynolds announced daily COVID-19 cases and deaths by county, including the age ranges of those who became infected or died. As the tallies swelled, Reynolds' office with the Iowa Department of Public Health assigned regional scores as a way of evaluating the pandemic's spread, tying the overall score to setting public policies. But then in early May, Reynolds' reporting practices changed. She stopped announcing daily cases and deaths on TV. She stopped sending out those statistics with news releases to the media and posts to the governor's website. She instead unveiled a new coronavirus. Iowa.gov's website showing total cases, deaths, and tests on a statewide and county level. It provided statewide demographic data in percentages, but not raw numbers, and not by county. The dashboard on the revised website includes a range of other COVID-19 metrics, such as number of Iowans who have recovered, percentage of positive tests, and long-term care outbreaks. But while the site provides graphics showing cases and recoveries over time, it does not provide such a graphic for deaths, making it hard for Iowans to track new deaths on a statewide and county level, and easily gauge whether they're rising or falling. The site also fails to provide demographic data by county for cases, recoveries, and deaths, including age range, gender, race, and ethnicity. It provides those demographic details only in statewide percentages, not raw numbers. Without the governor's daily announcement, Buck, scrambling for a way to gauge her state's progress in fighting COVID-19, began keeping her own spreadsheet and doing her own math. Quote, "I have to add and subtract and figure out how many deaths there were," she told the Gazette. "I've been keeping my own chart and tally since this new website started," unquote. Reynolds' decision to de-emphasize the number of new cases and deaths on television and to stop providing demographic data for communities, including that overall regional score she had pointed to as important in setting policy, comes at a time she is increasing the ability of Iowans to sit down for a meal at a restaurant, get a haircut, work out at a gym, and go shopping. Reynolds said Iowans would need to decide for themselves, taking into account their own circumstances, whether to venture out. Quote, "Everybody is going to make their own decisions," she said. "Even though we have eased the mitigation requirements on some of our businesses, restaurants, salons, churches, you still have individual businesses. Some are ready to open up, and they're moving forward. Others are continuing to make sure that they can do it in a safe and responsible manner. And then Iowans are going to take the responsibility to decide if they are ready to go out and participate at the businesses or go to a restaurant." But Western Iowa Buck asked, "How can Iowans do that without accessible and consumable information about community spread at the local level?" Quote, "It seems to me she's trying to avoid it, especially the death count, so people don't hear it," she said. "If you don't hear it and don't think about it, it will go away, and it will be okay to clean up. That concerns me," unquote. Addressing concerns about the data being released, Governor's spokesman Pat Garrett praised the timeliness of the revamped website, noting the state is giving Iowans more information than they had before. "Instead of updating news conference viewers with numbers that already are a day old," Garrett said, "the website now provides data as of 11:59 p.m., and the state is working to make it more timely with updates more regularly," he said. Quote, "What we are providing is much more timely data than we've ever had before," he said. Nonetheless, the more current data still is available 11 hours before Reynolds goes on live TV. Providing it on the website instead of also on television does not reach Iowans who don't have internet access or familiarity in how to use it. As to removal from its website of regional COVID-19 rankings previously used to assess the severity of the pandemic spread across Iowa, Garrett said that data has lost relevance. Quote, "With Test Iowa, the state now has the ability to drill down to a county, city, zip code to analyze the spread of the virus and determine mitigation strategies," he said. But the state has not shared that level of local data with the public. Garrett didn't address the Gazette's questions about why the state isn't providing the same data and graphics for deaths as it is for total cases, or why the governor stopped announcing daily cases and deaths during her TV briefings. After fielding a range of queries from reporters about the data gaps, however, Reynolds opened her news conference Friday in a more familiar fashion, first announcing, "Over the week, we have seen our positive case count stabilize." Quote, "Today we are reporting that we have 374 new positive cases and 3,888 negative cases," she said. "Days to double continues to improve. Today it's 18 days, which speaks to the slowing of the spread of the virus." She reported, "Unfortunately, 18 Iowans have lost their lives to COVID-19. In response to media questions earlier in the week, Reynolds asserted that information is not being limited. Quote, "We're trying to provide more access to Iowans, and we're trying to do it in a timely fashion," she said, noting she too felt some frustration in navigating the changing website. "Even as I'm trying to manage through the system, it's changed. It's changing daily as we're learning more and trying to provide Iowans with more timely information," Reynolds said. "I like the graphs, but it is changing, and it is fluid right now." Iowa Department of Public Health Deputy Director Sarah Reiseter said her department is taking the feedback and making adjustments. Quote, I can tell you that they're actively working to provide some more information, she said. But we're doing it carefully. We're doing it diligently. But we do expect in the next week or so to be able to provide some more functionality. And some of the things that you're referencing that are currently lacking, I would expect to see some of them come back for you, unquote. The information is coming late, though as many previously shuttered parts of Iowa's economy already have blinked back to life, reigniting marketplace competition and putting some business owners in a tight spot, according to Senator Claire Selce, the Democrat from West Des Moines. Quote, what I've been getting is, why don't they track county-level data anymore? She said of the feedback she has received from constituents. If you have a business in Polk County or in Johnson County, you want to know what the data is among your customers, she said. They're the ones that are going to be frequenting your business, unquote. Selce said lawmakers, like the public, stopped getting the daily case and death tolls they relied on, prompting her to reach out to the governor's office for more information. But her follow-up questions have gone unanswered, she said, and it's frustrating. Quote, nobody's personally blaming Kim Reynolds for the pandemic, she said, but they are now starting to blame her for any actions moving forward that involve opening up the state without data to support it. And I think that's where I would hold her. Selce said she sent emails to the public health department asking for information, arguing, quote, you guys keep telling us this data is here, and it's not, unquote. Reynolds has urged Iowans with questions or concerns to call, although there is no clear number for data-related questions on the website dashboard. Senator Joe Bolcom, Democrat from Iowa City, said he too has concerns about changes in how the state is reporting data. He also has started maintaining his own spreadsheet. Quote, the new dashboard made it really significantly harder for Iowans to track the day-to-day progress of the pandemic, unless you looked at the website yesterday and wrote down the numbers the day before that, or the day before that, he said. It just doesn't make any sense. We're collecting the data. We should make it available to Iowans with an interest in tracking this pandemic, unquote. That, according to Bolcom, should include data on testing, which experts and analysts have heralded as paramount to any reopening effort. Although the governor's dashboard shows total testing, county-level testing, and a daily progression of testing in Iowa, it doesn't break down the numbers by type or mode of testing, including how much has been accomplished under the $26 million Test Iowa initiative. Instead, the state's dashboard is providing only the number of Test Iowa assessments Iowans have completed to determine who qualifies for a test. Assuming the state has this information, daily number of tests by type, daily death tallies by county, and demographic details at the local level, 69-year-old Dennis Fett, who said he voted for Reynolds, argues the governor should release it. Quote, I don't care if she tells me bad news, he said. I just want to know it so I can make my own decisions.
Hi there, everyone. My name is Jenner Lathrop, and I will now be taking over reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette, starting first with the obituaries. First up today, we have Irvin F. Wells, known as Luke, 85, out of Anamosa. Mr. Wells died Monday on May 11th, 2020, following a brief illness. Luke was a man of dedication with unwavering moral values. He was as stubborn as he was jovial, and more than anything, he enjoyed greeting people with a smile and a joke and to make them feel welcomed. His dedication to and love for his family were perhaps his most defining characteristics. He was always prepared to make any sacrifice for their betterment. For that, his family will remain ever in his debt. His second love was for his church and its members, whom he considered family just the same, and whom he gladly served for decades with great joy. Pastor Mark Ortgias will officiate at a celebration of Luke's life at 1 p.m. Saturday, May 23rd. In light of the current health crisis, his immediate family will gather at the Gotch Funeral Home in Anamosa, and extended family and friends may gather at the Springs of Life Foursquare Church in Anamosa to join the celebration via web stream. Those unable to attend are welcome to log in to view the service from their homes. Those who wish to maintain social distance are welcome to join the family for burial, which will be in the Riverside Cemetery, Anamosa, following the service at 2 p.m. Thoughts, memories, and condolences may be shared with Luke's family at goechonline.com. That's G-O-E-T-T-S-C-H online.com. Links to the webstream service will be posted in the obituary on the website as well. Luke was born on February 13, 1935, in Anamosa, the son of Millard and Irma Wells. On June 20, 1959, he married the former Bernita Doctorman at the United Methodist Church in Central City. The couple made their home in Anamosa, and Luke was employed in a number of positions, including Clinton Engines in Maquoketa, Collins Radio, and the Leaf Bureau Corporation, both out of Cedar Rapids. Before retirement in 2004, he was the backroom manager at the former Family Food Store in Anamosa. Luke was a charter member of the Springs of Life Foursquare Church. He was a member of the Anamosa JCs and the Promise Keepers Christian Organization, and volunteered for many years at the Grant Wood Art Gallery in downtown Anamosa. During spare time, Luke loved woodworking and leather making, working alongside Bernita to create arts and crafts and presenting them at art shows around the area. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family. Warren Marshall Ferguson, 87, of Cedar Falls. Mr. Ferguson died on Wednesday, May 13, 2020, at Western Home Communities, Deary Suites. He was born on November 10, 1932, in Shellsburg, Iowa, the son of Raymond and Gladys Ferguson. He married Janelle Peterson on March 1, 1953, in Vinton, Iowa. She preceded him in death on November 29, 2019. He graduated from high school in 1952 and served in the U.S. Army from 1953 to 1955, stationed in Europe. He then attended the Iowa State Teachers College and worked for Martin Brothers in Cedar Falls for 41 years, retiring in January 1995. He was a member of Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Cedar Falls. Due to the pandemic, a private family service and burial will be held at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton, where military honors will be conducted by the Iowa Army National Guard. A celebration of life will be planned for a later date. Richardson Funeral Service is assisting the family and can be contacted at 319-266-3525. Memorials and condolences may be sent to the family at Warren's home address in Cedar Falls. Mr. Ferguson enjoyed winters in Arizona, walking around the neighborhood, and spending time with family, friends, and neighbors. Next, Ms. Deborah K. Hood, 69, of Cedar Rapids, died on Wednesday, May 13, 2020, in her home. Celebration of Life services will be live-streamed starting at 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 19th, on Brosh Chapel's Facebook page. Friends and family are encouraged to view and leave a condolence during this time. Private family interment will be at a later date. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids are in charge of arrangements. Deborah was born on February 10, 1951, in Cedar Rapids, the daughter of Ernest Edward and Pauline Irene Lint. She was preceded in death by her mother, Pauline Lint, stepdaughter, Michelle Brown Daugherty, and her aunt, Geraldine Strait. Memorials may be directed to the family. Next, Douglas Lee Wayne Keller, known as Doug, 47, passed away on Tuesday, May 12, 2020, from complications of diabetes in Iowa City. Private family services will be held at T. Hend Funeral Home. Burial will be at St. Joseph Cemetery at a later date. His nieces and nephews and countless other women and men saw him as a massive father, uncle, and grandfather figure and a dear friend. Doug will be dearly missed by his mother, Peggy, father, Eldon, siblings, Mary, Alyssa, and Dennis, and many of those nieces and nephews. Doug was born in Cedar Rapids at St. Luke's Hospital on September 13, 1972, to Peggy McAllister and Eldon Keller. He graduated from Kennedy High School in 1992, where he was an avid wrestler. Doug enjoyed watching Hawkeye football and basketball and the Dallas Cowboys. He had many passions, including fishing, hunting, trapping, carpentry, cooking and baking, and the most amazing, non-traditional sense of humor you could ever find. Doug had a heart of gold that no person could tarnish, no matter the circumstances. He taught us to be unapologetically ourselves and to love with every piece of our heart and soul, a lesson no one should forget. Next, Ms. Elizabeth Frances Ford Lamb, 95, of Anderson, South Carolina, passed away Monday, May 11th, 2020, at Brookdale Assisted Living of Anderson. Born November 2nd, 1924, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, she was the daughter of the late Leo Michael Ford and Catherine Marie Hutchinson Ford. She was married to the late Charles A. Lamb until his passing in 2002. Elizabeth was a graduate of the University of Iowa, where she received a Bachelor of Liberal Arts degree and was a member of the Delta 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 sorority. She loved playing golf and bridge and enjoyed gardening. Elizabeth cherished her time as a weekly volunteer at Ann Med Health. She was also a member of St. Mary Catholic Church. The family would like to thank the staff at Brookdale Assisted Living of Anderson for the loving care that they provided to Mrs. Lamb. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the Cancer Association of Anderson, located at 215 East Calhoun Street, Anderson, South Carolina, 29621. Next, Mr. Alfred Ernest Moreau, 68, of Arlington, Virginia, passed away Wednesday, April 29th, 2020, at home, surrounded by his wife and children. Beloved husband of 37 years to Elaine A. Eder, devoted father of Elizabeth, Andrew, and Eileen, he was the first son of the late Anthony N. Doreen Moreau, brother of Colleen and Roland, and nephew of Dorothy. In addition to his parents, he was preceded in death by aunts Pauline, Anne Marie, and Alfreda, and uncle Clifford. He is survived by dear family nieces and nephews and cousins in Vermont and Nebraska. Due to the pandemic, services and interment of ashes, as well as a celebration of life, will be planned after gathering restrictions are lifted. We encourage you to leave a message of condolence and fond memories for the family on the online guestbook at www.moneyandking.com. Next, Ms. Irma O. Rayburn, 103, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died Sunday, May 10th, 2020, at West Ridge Care Center after a long fight with Alzheimer's. She has now been reunited with her husband, William Rayburn. A private family burial will take place at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family with arrangements. Irma was born on July 12, 1916, in Hawleyville, Iowa, and spent her early life in Taylor County, Iowa. She was the daughter of the late Martin Edward Madden of Hawleyville and the late Bertha Louise Madden, also of Hawleyville. She graduated from high school in New Market, Iowa, in 1936. Irma was united in marriage to William Rayburn on June 1, 1941, in Maryville, Missouri, and enjoyed 78 years of marriage until his death on January 18, 2020. She was a member of Sharon United Methodist Church in Cedar Rapids for 75 years. Irma worked as a school teacher until her marriage. She focused on her children and grandchildren. After they were raised, she spent almost 30 years volunteering at St. Luke's Hospital. Irma loved crafts, gardening, and traveling with her husband. Together, she and Bud traveled to 49 states and especially enjoyed trips to Hawaii, one that included their entire family. Her love for her husband and her family was immense. Irma leaves behind a lifetime of memories and love. Memorials may be directed to Sharon United Methodist Church. And now a note from Irma's children. Mom and Dad walked together for 80 years, and each day lived the words of this poem. When Dad died in January, we knew Mom would soon run to be with him. I hope we walk the last mile together. Hand in hand, we can see the promised land. We've been through bad times, but our love is forever. We made our house a home for our little ones. We've known happiness and some sadness, too. I remember when you first said, I love you. I didn't know a love could be so strong, and today I find you're still mine, so let's go on forever. We will walk the last mile together. By Margaret Newsom Holly. Next, Mr. Jeff D. Russell, 72, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, formerly of Monona, Wisconsin, passed away on Monday, May 11th, 2020, after a 4-year battle with pancreatic cancer. He was born on June 22nd, 1947, to Donald and Lucille Russell in Glenwood, Minnesota. Jeff grew up in Monona, Wisconsin, and graduated from Monona Grove High School in 1965. He then went on to the University of Wisconsin, where he majored in electrical engineering. He received his bachelor's degree in 1970, his master's degree in 1971, and his PhD in 1973. While at the University of Wisconsin, Jeff was inducted into the Honorary Engineering and Research Societies of Eta Kappa Nu, Tau Beta Pi, and Sigma Xi. Jeff spent most of his working life in Cedar Rapids as an electrical engineer for the Collins Radio Division of Rockwell International. Within 5 years of being hired, he rose from a technical staff member to a technical staff member number 3 to a technical staff member number 8, the highest existing engineering position and one that is rarely awarded. During his time at Rockwell Collins, Jeff was the inventor or co-inventor of 13 patents, mostly having to do with microprocessors. In 1977, his company was in competition with Magnavox and Texas Instruments for a federal government contract involving the first successful GPS receiver. Rockwell Collins won this contract, and Jeff developed the computer subsystem for it. Jeff's main hobby involved ham radio. Back in high school, he taught himself Morse code. Around 1984, he developed an automated Morse code transmitter called the Kansas City Kier. Those units were produced and sold as either kits or assembled commercial units, for which Jeff received royalties. Jeff is survived by one brother and sister-in-law, Clayton and Barbara, 3 nephews, Clayton, Alan, and Donald, and a longtime friend, Jeff, also out of Cedar Rapids. Arrangements are with the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids. Nellie Yvonne Oliver, known as Susie, of Iowa City, died peacefully greeting the beautiful sunrise of May 12, 2020 at Legacy Gardens in Iowa City. Susie was born on Thanksgiving Day in 1939 in Kanawha, Oklahoma, to Joe Don and Charles Edwards. She and her brother Monty grew up in Maumee and later Norris City, Illinois. Susie enjoyed band and theater in high school, where she met her first husband, Thomas Oliver. They were married on the winter solstice 1957 and welcomed 3 children into the world. Susie studied chemistry and helped Tom with his PhD dissertation at Southern Illinois University. She then dedicated many years to her children and family. They moved to Iowa City in 1972, where Tom was an ACT executive. Susie had a second career as a medical secretary for Dr. Thomas Viner of Otolaryngology Medical Services in Iowa City and rural Iowa. Susie and her second husband, Thomas Summey of Iowa City, were married in May of 1994. They enjoyed traveling to each of the 50 states, the U.S. presidential libraries, Europe, Asia, Africa, and Hawkeye sports. She was engaged to George Gay. They traveled between Iowa City and Texas, and much more travel was anticipated. Susie was a supporter of the First Christian Church, the Performing Arts at Hancher, and was dedicated to empowering women as a member of the philanthropic educational organization. Susie was a dedicated genealogy hobbyist and enjoyed tracking down courthouse records, visiting abandoned graveyards, Civil War sites, and contacting distant relatives. She enjoyed all types of games, family and high school reunions, vacations, flowers, quilting, playing bridge, Wednesday coffee, and her many cherished friends, cousins, nieces, and nephews. Susie will be remembered for her ever-present smile and love of life. Next, Miss Dolores Suchamel, formerly of Mount Vernon in Cedar Rapids, died on May 2nd, 2020 at Bishop Drum Retirement Center in Johnston of COVID-19. She was 93. Dolores Mary Kahlberg was born on January 17, 1927, in Muscatine, to Frank and Mary Kahlberg. She grew up on a farm near Nichols and graduated from Nichols High School in 1945. She graduated from Mount Mercy College in Cedar Rapids in 1947. Dolores married Harold Suchamel of Cedar Rapids on August 3, 1949. They soon moved to Mount Vernon, where they raised their 6 children and lived for the next 63 years. Dolores was a capable and organized household manager, and an after-school childcare provider for several families. She also provided telephone answering services in her home for two local businesses. One of those businesses led her to a full-time 30-year career with Hertz Farm Management in Mount Vernon. During retirement, she enjoyed volunteering at Mercy Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Dolores was a member of St. John's Catholic Church and was active on many committees. She was also the church's self-appointed welcoming committee, usually being the first person visitors and new members met. In 1970, Dolores was honored as the University of Iowa's Mother of the Year. Dolores spent her final years in nursing care because of the ravages of Alzheimer's disease. A funeral mass will be held once restrictions on gatherings have been loosened. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. Because we are unable to gather together during this time, please share your support and memories with Dolores' family on her tribute wall at www.stuartbaxter.com under the Obituaries tab. Next, Anne Holloway Scannell Huxell, of 93, of Chelsea, Michigan, passed away on April 18, 2020, of COVID-19. Anne grew up in Center Point in Iowa City. She was preceded in death by her husband, Don, daughter, Kay, and sister, Ellen. She is survived by two daughters, two grandchildren, and her brother, Robert. Next, Darlene Ann Suchamel, 88, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, May 13, 2020, at her rural Urbana home, surrounded by her family. Darlene was born on August 27, 1931, in Clarksville, the daughter of Benjamin and Gertrude Dickman. She graduated from Marble Rock High School with the class of 1949, attending Wartburg College and Iowa State Teachers College, where she earned her teaching certificate. Darlene was united in marriage to John A. Suchamel on August 15, 1953, in Decorah. Darlene was a teacher at the Urbana Elementary School for 10 years. Following her teaching career, she worked with her husband, John, at the Urbana Savings Bank until her retirement. Private family services will be held, and a burial at the Urbana Cemetery. Offer condolences at www.phillipsfuneralhomes.com. Next, Gail Louise Eklund passed away at age 86, on May 4, 2020, surrounded by her family. She had been a resident of Williamsburg, Virginia for the past 35 years and was formerly of Cedar Rapids. She was preceded in death by her husband, Ron Eklund. Gail was a military wife and homemaker, generous, thoughtful, and kind in all she did. She loved to cook, shop, and travel and see the world. She made annual trips, driving her van to Iowa to visit family. Gail was a member of the Kingsmill Women's Social Club, where she led the Third Thursday Lunch Brunch, was active in both Mahjong and Wine and Dine groups, and volunteered in the Kingsmill Garden Club. Gail was one of the original members of the Antique Adventures Club, a member of the CIAO Social Club, a friend of WRL, and a supporter and volunteer at the Williamsburg Botanical Garden. Services and interment will be held in spring 2021 at Arlington National Cemetery, where Gail will be laid to rest next to her husband. In lieu of flowers, donations to Gail's memory may be made to the Williamsburg Botanical Garden in Williamsburg, Virginia, or can be made online at www.williamsburgbotanicalgarden.org. And our final obituary for today, Mr. Alan D. Morris, 84, of Wapapello, Missouri, rose to meet his Savior Jesus Christ on May 12, 2020, from advanced COPD. He was the son of Clarence and Isla Morris of Toddville, Iowa. He had four brothers, John, Lyle, Kenny, and Nelson, and a sister, Betty. Alan was united in marriage to Janet Morris on July 25, 1954. They went on to have four sons. The Reverend David Morris, the Reverend Douglas Morris, Mr. Jeff Morris, and the Reverend Joel Morris. His children had 11 grandchildren and 21 great-grandchildren. Dad took great pleasure in his grandchildren and great-grandchildren and enjoyed every minute he could spend with them. He was a retiree of Collins Rockwell and Oral-B Labs in Iowa City. He was a member of the Bluff Church in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, and Toddville Free Methodist Church. He served the community by being a founding member of Otter Creek Lions Club, a founding member of the Monroe Township Volunteer Fire Department. He also served on the Albernette School Board, and most recently, the Eagles. He had a great love for woodworking and made very nice furniture and crafts after his retirement. He was a friend to many and will be missed. A service is being planned for late June in Toddville.